are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
First of all, welcome to Serious Growth Podcast.
Thank you, sir.
This is where I hang out and talk about all kinds of stuff. I don't know if you've seen any of the podcast, but we talk about everything and anything, and we can say whatever we want. We're still in an open society here, at least in this podcast, so we can feel free to say whatever the hell we want, just so you know baby. That.
When's your birthday, sir?
5/18/1955.
Oh, you're so strong.
How about, 65 years of age? Yeah, you know, when I was 30, I didn't think I'd make it this far, so I'm pretty lucky.
You look good. You have great hair.
Thank you. And I've been training for about 30 years. I got into bodybuilding, and for me, that was life-changing. It took me on to my career as someone who is personal training with clients, you know, because once I saw what kind of transformation I can make, I wanted to share that. And it sounds to me the same thing with you. You're a teacher. Are you a teacher by trade?
Yes.
Okay. And so I'm kind of the same way, and I wanted to teach other people how to transform themselves. And what was unexpected about it for me, I'm sure that maybe you feel the same way, is how amazed that people were. They were, you know, to the point where they would tell me I saved their life. I just couldn't believe the things that they were saying to me. You know, I didn't think of it like that. I was just happy to help them. But it really impacts people's lives. And I'm sure that you're, in what you do with Pilates and teaching, you've done the same thing.
That's all you need is a desire to help someone.
Yeah, really. So tell me, on your bio, you said that you help actors, let me see here, get ready for movies. What does that exactly mean?
Well, it can mean several things. They don't look like that when they start, superstars. They can just have a baby or a back problem or be overweight. So I trained Carrie Ann Moss for The Matrix, took 15 pounds off of her. When you train someone for a movie, it's different than training someone for life.
Right.
Is they're training for an event. For instance, they're training for a character. So maybe their character's got to be have a lot of muscles. I did a movie called Clan of the Cave Bear, and they were all Neanderthals, so they had to have a different body. Someone's going to be doing night shoots, or they're going to be doing a love scene, or they're going to be doing special effects like wire work. Mm-hmm. So you're actually training them for what they're going to be doing. For instance, they can come and they have a lot of weight, or they're inflexible. A lot of the actors, you get them ready for this training, for the stunts.
Yeah. Tell me what your background is. I mean, when you say training, that can mean a lot of things. So can you give me an idea exactly? I mean, I get that you're training somebody for a movie. I did the same thing with Kevin Costner, by the way. So I understand what you're saying. But
nice guy.
For the people that are listening, what exactly does that mean in detail?
Okay. Well, first it means I have a big background in yoga therapy. So it's their diet. What is their diet in terms of, as you know, as a trainer, either dropping weight or building muscle or detoxing?
Yeah.
Would be one thing. Recovering from people who normally have a bad back and bad shoulders and bad necks. Going slow with them and systematic with them so that they can do, for instance, something like a night shoot. When you're working on a movie, you're working with a team. It's different than just having a private client.
No.
So that person may be doing, like on The Matrix and on Kill Bill, they're doing their martial arts. So you're working with a Chinese trainer.
Yeah.
You're working with, they're doing motorcycles. So you got to get someone ready for their extension to do motorcycles. They're working with wire work. So they have to go upside down and twist. Yeah. Maybe they've got migraines and headaches, so you have to address everything for them to get ready to do that trick or that role.
Yeah. And are you actually on set when you do stuff like this? Okay.
I've done 10 feature locations where you're on set, and that's because there has to be a consistency.
Yeah.
For instance, something like The Matrix was 100 shooting days over a two-year period, so they have to be the same body in the beginning and the middle as the end.
Yeah.
And you're there to first build the body, then maintain the body. On that movie, they broke her knee, so I had to rehab her with a broken leg.
Wow.
That sort of thing, yeah.
And so you're really, seems like you're really strong. You said Pilates therapy, is that what you called it?
Well, yoga therapy.
Or yoga therapy.
Yoga therapy, and then Pilates is actually more conditioning work.
Okay.
The yoga therapy would be something like, let's say you can't go to sleep. Pilates isn't good if you can't go to sleep, but there's yoga techniques to go to sleep.
I see.
You're going to be doing night shoots, and so you have to be up.
Yeah.
You know, so when are you stimulating and when are you sedating?
Right. And how did you get into the movie where you're training a lot of these actors? How did that happen? Were you an actress yourself?
No.
No?
I have to say location. I was in Beverly Hills, and I was doing my Pilates training at a Pilates studio in the 80s. In the 80s, there was only like 100 studios in America.
Yeah.
And so all the actresses trained there.
Oh.
So I started out doing massage and diet in a Pilates studio. And then I started to learn the Pilates method, which is completely different than yoga or anything else. And I went on my first movie, 1984. And then I did Glenn Close and LeVar Burton and all these other movies, going on set with them to keep them into a, be able to keep their body durable for the duration of the movie.
Yeah, you know what I learned with Kevin? Kevin and I were actually high school, we went to the same high school for 1 year. He moved from Southern California. I'm in Central California. And anyway, so he was here for 1 year, as it turned out, and he played baseball. And so the next thing I know, you know, he's gone. And then he shows up on The Untouchables. And I was watching that movie, and I thought, you know, that guy looks familiar. And so we called him Ricketts because he had bad knees and all this kind of stuff. But one of the things that was pretty amazing, anyway, I during that time is when I just broke into all this personal training and all that. So when I hunted him down, I got the name of the studio. I just left a message thinking, oh, what the heck, you know, if he calls back, fine. 4 days later, he calls back. And I said, what the hell? When did you get into acting? You know, you're just a skinny guy with bad knees. Anyway, I went down there. He said, why don't you come out and train me for the Dances with the Moves, Dances with the Wolves movie. What I didn't really understand was how important, he said, look, I'm going to tell you something right now. I want you to train me, but I can't change my look. I have a specific look on camera. And if you add 2 or 3 pounds, it's going to change that. I didn't realize how important that was. All right, let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our product.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're going to get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you Big Beyond Belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
Yeah, well, to maintain the character. For instance, something like The Matrix, they're in these PVC costumes, so they can't gain weight.
Right.
Or it rips.
Yeah.
So it's changing their body for the character, and sometimes they're really muscular, but the next movie they're playing a wimp, and you got to soften them.
Yeah.
And you're usually, there's two things. One is training them before the movie, which, as you know, is more, and then they're doing 12-hour shoots, so you're just sustaining them either at lunchtime or on the weekend then.
Yeah. Interesting. I know it was eye opening for me, you know, because I didn't have that awareness. So when he told me that, he was dead serious. And he goes, don't you dare do that. Mm-hmm. He said it in a nice way, but he was very serious about that. And then I finally realized that, oh man, the camera does make a difference, you know, and that character, obviously that's how he makes his living. So I got to be careful with that. Right.
Yeah. You see someone like a Robert De Niro, they put on weight, they lose weight.
Yeah. Yeah.
They change their posture. Something like the movie I did with the Neanderthals, Clan of the Cave Bear, they have to spend all day hunched over a fire, or they have to spend all day in a certain character. And then you have to like kind of take them out of that physicality so that they can get back to normal.
Yeah.
It depends. Sometimes you're hired by the actor. Sometimes you're hired by the producer.
Yeah. Did you ever have to deal with people melting down? You know, I mean, I know as a personal trainer, you have to play, you have to wear different hats. And one of the hats is, you know, you got to become a, like a pseudo shrink, you know, to keep people in that, in their pathway, because, you know, some, especially when they're stressed out and they're under pressure, they melt down sometimes, and you gotta be able to make them productive even when they can't help themselves sometimes.
Well, I find that when they're coming to your studio or you're in a gym, you're in a structured environment and they show up and it's very disciplined. Once you leave the gym and you go to their house or you go to another country or you go on the set, you've lost that control.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, when they come to you, they're performing really well, but now maybe they have a drug problem or they have an alcohol problem, or in many, many cases, they have an entourage problem.
Hmm, interesting.
You know, you're trying to get the actress to lose weight, but their assistant is bringing them,
they have,
you
all,
know,
all these yes
bagels and cream cheese.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so then you've got a political situation where you're vying for the person's time and attention, and that becomes more challenging than a body.
Did you have to, in an eloquent way, because I get the sense that you're a very eloquent person in the way you present things, did you ever have to say, look, entourage, get the hell out of here. You're in my way. You're screwing this whole thing up in a nice way.
Oh, yeah. I have no trouble because it's my job. I'll give you an example. I was with an actress and she'd done many movies and had an assistant, but then she went vegetarian. So her assistant's bringing her potatoes and rice because it's vegetarian.
Right.
And she used to be into maybe alcohol and drugs. So whenever she had a problem, you know, a headache or cramps or sleeping, they're giving her things. I'm like, no, this is the program now. We're doing tea. Yeah. We're doing meditation. So yes, I have no problem within my sphere.
Yeah.
There's only one alpha mare in the pasture.
Yes, exactly right. That's true. I had some experience of that when I used to train a lot of professional athletes. You know, these guys are highly paid, and in some cases, oh, look, most of them were fine to work with. But you had that small group that was, you know, look, I make a lot of money and I know more than you are, than you do, even though I hired you, you know, that kind of thing. But I learned early on, I never took that kind of crap. And so, as a matter of fact, I used to call it wiping the slate clean. And with me, I didn't train anybody with Pilates or yoga. I did it with weight training, sport-specific conditioning, because it's for their, you know, what they do. And I would just, I called it putting them over the rail. I had a rail at my facility. If I had to get somebody's attention, I would kick their ass to the point where they go throw up on the side of the rail. And then all of a sudden they were different people to deal with, you know? It's like, okay, I get it, you know?
I think there are some people who know how to train and some people you don't. And then you have to also train the mind.
Right.
But usually actors and athletes have such discipline.
Yeah.
And when you set the goals.
Right.
And you're clear on what the goals are and the schedule is. It's different, you know, with women, because they can get a lot more emotional.
Yeah.
So I hate to say it, but sometimes I use astrology.
Yeah.
Because if a woman gets too emotional and she's, you know, the boyfriend was mean to her and she doesn't get out of bed for 3 days, then we're not going to hit the gym.
Yeah, exactly. Huh.
So it depends on their mentality and how disciplined they are. If they say they're going to give up bread and not eat bread, or they're not disciplined. And that's a, you know, as you know, that's a give and take situation there.
Right. Yeah, and it's tricky. I mean, look, good coaches don't get enough, accolades for what they do because of what you're saying. It's, you know, you can't treat everybody the same as a teacher or as a coach. You have to know how to, again, get what you want out of them for them to reach their goal. And that's not always an easy thing to do, but the great ones and the good coaches know how to do that. You know, so you're speaking my language. I can tell that you've had a lot of experience with that.
Well, I think the body's kind of easy, but it's the mind that's difficult.
Oh, definitely. Starts there.
So you have to listen to the person. For instance, some people are more scientific. They want to know, you know, how long, how much, what am I working, what's the cost. Other people don't care. So you have to find out how you're going to communicate with them, you know, how much coddling, how much discipline.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have that energy to work with.
And it's an interesting balance. I always found it very challenging, and I got a lot of joy out of, you know, being able to make somebody like that really excel. I felt really good because it was a challenge. I like challenges. you know, so that was one of the things I always enjoyed. I need to ask you, when it comes to your training clients, your people for these actors, for example, did you ever do any kind of resistance training, or was it all Pilates and yoga?
Well, the resistance that you're using in Pilates is spring-loaded. It's springs for resistance. And then you're using your own body weight, similar to gymnastics.
Okay, so I thought that spring was body through space. So what is spring training, or spring resistance? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, I'll show you here if you can see. Yeah,
I got to see this.
So Pilates was a guy who invented exercise equipment at the same time he invented his method. So everything is based on springs.
Okay.
So you can go real heavy springs, real light springs.
Oh, I got you. Okay. That's so, it's kind of like band training.
It's kind of like band training, right. But it's a little bit higher than resistance level. For instance, if someone was in physical therapy, they might be just on really light TheraBands.
Yeah.
For an injury, and this would come afterwards.
Gotcha. Okay, you cleared that up very well. And then, so tell me then what the real difference is between, again, educating myself and the people that are listening to this, the difference between yoga and Pilates.
Well, yoga is a Hindu system that's 3,000 to 5,000 years old. And the purpose of yoga is to meditate and achieve, you know, union with the omniscient, omnipresent force. Pilates is German. It's an external system. It has no God in it, has no religion in it. And the purpose is to have a symmetrical body and a sound mind. So there's an external system of equipment. There's about 10 different inventions that are still in use today. And so this would appeal to different personalities. For instance, if someone is a heavy Christian, they might find yoga to be part of the occult and not be mentally attracted to that.
Because it's Hindu?
Because it's Hindu, right. Okay. So in yoga, there's in true yoga, which isn't so taught today, it's been, you know, polluted just like Pilates has, there's meditation, there's do's and don'ts, there's all these lifestyle things. In Pilates, there's not a lifestyle things. I don't care your sexuality, your dreams, your past lives. It's strictly your knee, your back, your stomach.
Right.
That's psychologically easier.
Okay. Yo, interesting. Well, very good. All right. So then how is the, when you do the yoga training, exactly, what are some of the steps that you go through? I'm assuming there's a lot of mental techniques and therapy that you have to do first to really get the most out of that?
Yeah, so it depends what the person needs. Like for instance, the yoga system is something you could do as a paraplegic in a chair.
As long as you have your mental faculty.
Because there's maybe 100 different breath techniques, and there's different techniques you can do for your brain.
Yeah.
So you can be injured, you can be old, you can be on an airplane. There's lots of yogic techniques when they're taught right. It's not just people think yoga is like a lot of contortioning and downward dog and upward dogs,
yeah.
But that's not really true. It's just because the public was more attracted to that than disciplining themselves in their lifestyle or their diet.
So the yoga is something, it sounds to me like you can do on the fly. In other words, you can be on an airplane and mm-hmm. do a yoga technique.
You can do, I do a lot of techniques on the airplane, especially on the way to Australia or something. You got a 17 hour flight.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be rolling like a ball right. in the aisles there.
How do you, there's obviously distraction when you're on an airplane to a degree. So mm-hmm. how do you have to tune that out in order to get the most out of your yoga? And if so, how do you do that?
Well, you're very in a confined space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's all the micro movements you can do, you know, little spine twists, little flexes, your feet, your neck, alternate nostril breathing. There's lots of little techniques. My background's in Kundalini yoga, so it's a vaster system than just Hatha yoga. But even more than an airplane, it's more practical. Let's say you're in the dentist office, or you're in the doctor's office, or you're in jail or the cop's car.
Yeah.
You can do your breath techniques to keep yourself really calm and give yourself something to measure time with. I find with everybody's anxiety, You know, if they don't have a technique for their anxiety, whether it's listening to music or, you know, what they do to calm themselves down, it's something very technical for the mind you can give someone. I was just watching a movie on Netflix, and the criminal guy, every time he was doing something, he was doing these things with his fingers. It was this little technique.
Oh, interesting.
And I know that that came from someone who taught him. So something like that, it's passing the time.
Yeah.
It gives you a sense of counting. You can do your breath techniques, and that's very, very small and not very, doesn't draw a lot of attention to yourself in a public space.
Yeah, interesting. Are you able to, I assume, combine yoga, like when you're training somebody, can you combine, again, if it's, there's no conflict, example, for religious reasons, are you able to use yoga and Pilates together, and is it better to get a compound effect from that, or no? Do they stand on their own?
It's a very good question. I kind of look at it like cooking. Like I can cook a great Mexican food and I can cook a great Italian food, but I don't put my monogotes into my enchiladas.
Yeah.
So I do like to keep it separate. I do like to teach people so they have these lifelong techniques. I'll give you an example. In Pilates, you would do a stretch, but you would like bounce 3 or 5 times and switch. Where in yoga, you would hold that same stretch for 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Okay, it's more static.
More static for the most part, yes. Yeah. So it kind of depends. It depends if I have all of my equipment, all of my tools. Let's say you have really tight hips. In the equipment, I'll have 4 or 5 different places I can put you underneath those springs to open up your hips.
Right.
If I'm on the road and I don't have those springs, then I may pull out more some hip openers from yoga.
Interesting. Yeah. And who was your, did you have a mentor when you got into the yoga side of it? Did you have a mentor that got you really into that? And were you able to meet some of these people?
Oh, yes. My mentor was Yogi Bhajan. And he was a very strict teacher. You know, you couldn't drink, you couldn't smoke, cold showers. 3 o'clock in the morning meditation. I went to India. I lived in ashrams. I did silence. I did all that stuff.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And I think actually the main thing we work with together, all of us work with, is giving somebody discipline and giving somebody a culture. As Americans, we don't have a culture. So the Indian culture of yoga, the German culture of Pilates, the boxing culture, the sports culture, you're putting somebody in a, even the gym has a culture.
Yes.
And you're giving somebody a culture that they don't have, a discipline and a structure.
Yeah. You know, I've often said that the motivation has to be greater than the obstacle. I refer this to training, but I think what tops all that is that you have to, the overall thing that you have to have is discipline. Would you agree with that? Because at some point the motivation runs out. It's, I compare it to like a, when you're first in a relationship, the honeymoon phase, but then what happens when the honeymoon phase is over, you know, type thing. And I just, and I don't know if you agree with that, but I've just often, because, you know, bodybuilding, it's a marathon, and it just being an athlete, you know, this, you know, there's a certain discipline, but bodybuilding, you know, it takes years and years and years to develop a physique that qualifies you to be up on a national stage, for example. Mm-hmm. And I just, it built such a ironclad discipline for me that it almost works against me sometimes. It can almost be dangerous because I override over the years, not now, but I've overridden some of the alerts my body was trying to tell me, like, you know, you got to stop this before I hurt you type thing. But would you agree with that as far as the discipline being the overriding, like the ace in the hole?
I think it depends on the circumstances. For instance, when you're working with a movie star, they're getting paid millions of dollars to get in shape. And that's their job. Their job is to get in shape. Like on The Matrix, we had 6 months of training for 6 hours a day. And they were getting paid to get in shape.
Yeah.
And they were getting paid. Their trainers were paid. The cook was paid. The PTs were paid. Same thing in athletics. They're competing and they want to be the best performance they can.
Yeah.
That's different than a normal person who is not getting paid to be in shape. Then you can make it something if they have an event, like they're going to get married or they're going to go to their high school reunion. Or, you know, I don't think people talk enough about that one of the reasons to really train is to just have a great sex life, you know, to be able to go for a couple hours, be able right. to take your clothes off and be in those positions, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So to me, that's always my motivation is yeah. like, yeah. you know, I want to stay sexy and happy.
Yeah. That's a good motivator for you.
Right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Now, when it comes to the, now the Pilates side of it, mm-hmm. who were the mentors that turned it all on for you?
My first teacher was in Beverly Hills. His name was Stefan Fries, and he trained me in what's now called a fusion style. But I met this lady, Ramona Krasanowski, and she was trained by Joe Pilates. When I met her, she was 68, and I spent 18 years with her. And she brought it back to the original work of Joe Pilates, which has been completely changed. So like bodybuilding has not changed. Boxing has not changed. People think that things should be improved or changed, whether it's the equipment or the system. So Ramona brought me back to, this is how Joe Pilates taught me, and that's the way I'm going to teach you. And you recognize the truth in your body. This feels right. Yeah. I feel better. This makes more sense. And it's, the formula has already been laid out. So again, it's like making a eggplant parmesan. I'm Italian, right?
Yeah.
Let's say you make a lasagna, and lasagna is lasagna. You go into a restaurant, you want lasagna, but now all of a sudden it's wheatless, dairyless, no yeah, oil, yeah. no salt, and no meat.
Yeah, you just ruined
so,
it.
Ramona served me lasagna, and that's what I serve. I don't change it because it's been here for 100 years and it works.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm just, yeah, so I just taught what I've been taught.
You know, I totally agree with you. And same thing has happened in the sport of bodybuilding. You know, there's always, I call it SOS. People are attracted to the shiny object syndrome. You know, that's what they have. The next best thing, you know, it's like, oh, train this way. This is the next best thing. And what I've learned over the years is that's not actually necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. And usually simple is better. There's some, like you said, there's some truths out there that don't change in my sport. And it's real interesting how, you know, when you're talking to other people where their head's at, and I base a lot of my stuff and back it by physiology. Look, this is the way your physiology works, whether mm-hmm. you like it or not. You can try to trick it and you might be able to do that temporarily, but in the long game, you're going to lose that one, you know, type thing. So I think we're talking about the same thing.
I think results is always what where it's at. If you get the results you want,
yeah.
that's what shows that it's right.
Yeah.
The Pilates is different than bodybuilding in that you don't work to muscle fatigue. You don't do a lot of repetitions. You can, but you don't. It's different. It's different that way. And the other thing in the Pilates, what makes it very interesting, you can see some of the equipment behind me.
Yeah.
Again, he was very German, and it's very exact with no wasted motions. Think like a Mercedes, a
right.
BMW, you know.
Yeah.
It's very, I want to say German, except when I was teaching in Austria, I felt embarrassed to tell the Germans. I said, it's very German. They're like, what? Where you can measure things. For instance, in bodybuilding, you're doing things like how much weight, how many reps, what range of motion.
Yeah.
With the equipment, you can see if someone's shoulders lower, someone's rib is popping out, someone's hip is higher. You're going for symmetry and you're measuring them into the square to see where they're weaker, where they're stronger, so that you can make their performance stronger.
Yeah.
Like, let's say, for instance, like a Madonna. I trained Madonna for 10 months for one of her tours. You can't really say you trained Madonna. You can only say you survived training Madonna.
I can imagine that.
like she sends in a spy first to see if you're any good. She does.
Really?
You know? Any restaurant or acupuncturist she goes to, she sends in someone first and they find out,
wow,
are you a professional? Do you start on time?
Yeah.
Do you gossip? Is your place clean? Do you know what you're doing? Because she doesn't want to waste her time.
Right. I love that though.
Yeah. It really raises your level up because you usually don't have people like that.
Right.
So with Madonna, she has a pretty perfect body. And it's just like, where are you? You're putting her through a system of movements to find where it's not perfect. That's
yeah.
what's interesting. So you can correct it and help her out.
Yeah, interesting. Very fascinating. Now, give me obviously you mentioned with weight training, it's about reps, it's about rest, it's about weight versus reps, you know, rest and all that. So in a Pilates training, is it how many reps are you doing, or is it, do you even count reps? Is it something different than that? Because I have no idea.
Yes, you count. You do count reps. It depends on what springs you're using. For example, I work with a lady who has a brain cancer. She's a Pilates teacher who got brain cancer. So I'm using very, very little resistance, but I'm doing a lot of repetitions for her endurance and for her stamina. If somebody comes in with a big weight training like you, you know, you can obviously look at the body. You don't have to interview them to see, you know, they walk in, you go, wow, you're in shape. I'm going to go right for flexibility and stretch.
Okay.
Because that's what they don't have.
Yeah.
And I might go for something like all the one leg balances, checking them out, their balances and their left side and their right side. A beginner is something different. Someone who's not in shape, you would start on a basic system, and that's a formula.
Yeah.
But when someone comes in, especially a man, training men is different than training women.
Right.
Mentally, and you have about 10 seconds to get their attention.
Yes.
Right? I have 10 seconds.
About right.
Right? So for the first thing I'll do something like a, I don't know if you can see in the background here, this chair is an original chair built by Joe Pilates, this exercise chair from the 60s. And I'll do one leg going up front right away to get their attention. So right away, I'm putting them in a different situation than just letting them do muscular exercises. The first thing you have to do is get somebody's attention.
Right. And that's what I was telling you about those athletes that came in, just the minors that came in and, you know, thought they knew more than I did, even though they hired me. So I had to get their attention. My way was just a little more radical in, you know, making them sick, but I get what you're saying.
Exactly. You have to get their attention and keep their mental attention with you.
Yeah.
And that's really challenging. I don't find that I work out as many men as I like to and as I understand it, and I respect this. I work out men when they're injured or when they're old. But sometimes men, and I understand this very clearly, when they're very serious, like the boxers, I would love to train the boxers. I've massaged them and helped them a lot of ways, but not train them, because when they're training for their fights, they don't want to be distracted by a woman, you know, even if I'm older. Yeah. You know, they don't want to look at my earrings or smell my perfume or see my breasts. They want to train.
Right.
And I think that is a real and respectful thing to listen to.
Yeah.
How to train a man as opposed to how to train a woman.
I found that over the years, when I first started personal training, it was in 82. And in my town, in my city, it was small. There wasn't anybody doing personal training for, you know, 50 miles. And the women had a very different perspective on weight training, resistance training, because they thought, well, the minute I start lifting weights, I'm going to turn out to be a Mr. Olympia. You know, this big muscular woman. And so consequently, most of my clientele early on was mostly men and a few females that were afraid of the gym, you know. And what I learned at that point was I had to go out and educate people and say, look, this is why you need weight training. It's the application of it, you know, and what you're trying to do. And now, fast forward to now, 90% or 80% of the people that I train in my facility, my personal training studio, is women. And I have to tell you, women are better clients than men, because I think I'm going to say, and maybe I'm going to go out and piss some people off, but I think it has to do with childbearing. I think you guys can put up a lot more pain than we can. We're sissies in so many ways. And we have a short, like you said, attention span. And but women are tough, man. And not to mention that maybe some of the, you know, they have to look, they feel like they have to lurk, you know, the vanity. I think that's maybe some motivation for some of them, but they're a much better client overall than a man any day.
Well, when you first said, you know, 1982, and you're talking 40 years ago, there really were very few gyms. There was just Gold's Gym,
right?
Few yoga studios, few Pilates studios, and dance studios. It wasn't until Jane Fonda started aerobics.
Yeah.
You know, and in the 90s even, there was no 24-hour fitness, Bali's or Equinox, right, or any of that. So the public has only recently come into that, and that's because it's profitable. It's profitable for the equipment, profitable making those equipment, you know?
Sure.
And, I didn't mean to just say, oh, it should be for your sex or for your body. I try to just make people have a sense of well-being and for their health, for their longevity.
Sure.
And I think that Pilates and yoga share that goal in longevity.
Yeah. And this may be a silly question, but Joe Pilates, is he still alive?
No, he died in 1967.
Oh, okay.
So he was born in 1883.
Wow.
Long time ago.
Yeah, obviously I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was born in 1883, and then he was a circus performer, actually, but not like a Cirque du Soleil circus performer. Circus in those days was just like a rough thing with people just starting to show their bodies and perform tricks. So he went to England during the summer to make money from Germany. World War I broke out, and the British interred 27,000 men, civilian men. Not military men, but civilian men. And they shipped him off to the Isle of Man, 27,000 men for 5 years.
Wow.
And so his whole circus troupe was arrested and shipped to the island. They were there, if you can imagine being in prison with 27,000 men.
Unreal.
For not doing anything other than your nationality, yeah. You know, the discrimination. And so whoever was in that, you know, it wasn't like an Auschwitz or anything. Whoever was in that prison, the Germans ran their own inside of the camp. So if you were a cook, you cooked. If you were a tailor, you sewed. And the culture in Germany at the turn of the century, they put gymnastics in all the school systems. So every child had to do gymnastics for 2 hours a day, A, so that they would have a ready-made army force.
Prepping them.
They would have everything ready for the army at a moment's notice. And two, so that the women could give birth to 7 or 8 kids and feed the army. So gymnastics was part of the culture.
Wow.
So he taught the warm-ups, and he taught his method, and he created this method when he was in prison for 5 years. And when he got out in 1918, back to Germany, which was Allied occupied, hot, massive inflation, no jobs, he started patenting and creating external equipment. And then he came to America in 1926. And he was sponsored here by Max Schmeling, not by Max Schmeling, who was a boxer, by Nate Fleischer, who was in charge of Ring Magazine, and he was a boxing promoter. So he sponsored Joe Pilates to come to New York, because Joe learned boxing from the British in the prison. But he was a little too old to be a boxer.
Yeah.
But he lost an eye to boxing. So he came to New York and he opened up a studio by Madison Square Garden to train the boxers. Not in boxing, but boxers have to train all day long, just like any athlete or actor. And so they're doing the bag, they're doing the jumping, they're doing their ring work, but they're also doing strength training.
Yeah. Interesting. That has quite a story, doesn't he?
He's got a great story.
Yeah.
A great story. So he worked with all the men for about 20 years, and you can imagine, being German, how much they hated, Americans hated German, because we were at war with them.
Oh, yeah.
First war, and then you got the second war with Hitler.
Yeah.
That'd be like having a trainer now, like from, I don't know, from like Iraq or North Korea,
yeah,
or Venezuela in New York trying to train people.
Yeah. I mean, that's totally uphill all the way, both ways.
Yeah. So he was extremely passionate, but he was extremely sure what he was doing.
Yeah.
And there were no gyms in that time. So when World War II broke out and all the men went to war, he started working with the female dancers. And in those days, nobody, again, had a gym. And the women with the Balanchine dancers, Martha Graham dancers, didn't want any upper body strength because they had to have long, lean, you know, muscles.
Yeah.
Like that. So the people tend to think now that Pilates is a dance method for women, but it's not. It's just been convoluted by the dancers.
Yeah.
Ruined, actually.
Interesting how that evolves or devolves. I mean, depending on
devolves.
Yeah,
yeah.
Devolves. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that guy had, I mean, he had a whole boatload of determination, didn't he? I think that he was so into what he was doing that no obstacle was going to stop him, no matter what. He's a genius.
Let's take a quick pause to tell you about something you are definitely going to want.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
He was a genius. Well, I think when he was in prison and he had the chance to work with thousands of bodies,
yeah,
he got a chance to see results. But again, in terms of, you know, what is similar or dissimilar between Pilates and yoga is this mind-body connection,
yeah,
which people have completely wrong.
How so?
Well, they think, oh, they just go, oh, you know, it's mind-body. They're the same. It's mind-body. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of what he was doing when he was in prison was keeping people from getting depressed, was addressing their anxiety. It's what we have today.
Yeah.
Right?
Big time.
We have this anxiety in our heart. We have this anxiety about everything right now, whether it's the virus or it's the government or it's the economy or it's our own mortality. We have this anxiety. And this depression. And so that's really what he was addressing and what you were talking about, getting people into the gym culture, which is you can reach the mind through the body or you can reach the body through the mind.
Right.
In yoga, you're concentrating on, you know, your breath or your imagination or your mantra or your meditation is connecting you with the higher force. In Pilates, you're really connecting your concentration, more like bodybuilding, is on your shoulder or on your stomach. And you're like, well, if I can get control of this, then I can get control of something.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I know. You know, I had a firsthand experience with the legitimacy of your mind and body connection because 8 years ago, I had 3 strokes that paralyzed me.
What?
Yeah. And I had 3 strokes in 3 weeks, to be exact. And so, you know, as a bodybuilder, we were always told there's a mind and muscle connection. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're in that sport and that age and you really want to believe that, you just believe it. I mean, just whether it's happening or not. When I was paralyzed, Siri, I actually had to really believe in that idea. And what I did, for example, to get myself back is I had my wife, I couldn't move one of my arms, and I had my wife come in because the body becomes its function. I learned that in Bulgaria when I trained with their athletes. They were very ahead of us, about 8 years ahead of us.
Bulgaria, oh my God.
Yeah, body becomes its function. Repetition is the mother of skill. That, you know, talk about some truths that are relative today, that they as relative today as they were then when I learned that. That's a great example of that. But I told my wife to come in every morning. She would start moving my arm like I was doing a curl, and I couldn't move it. All I was doing was looking at the movement. The Bulgarian said it takes 21 days for the body to adapt to a regimen. So I said, this is all I got. I mean, I didn't go have any rehab people work with me because their goals for me were to get me functional. And my goal was to get 100% back. So I said, screw you. I have bodybuilding in my background. I'm going to do this my way. And use the Bulgarians as my, you know.
That's the Taurus in you.
Yeah. And I'll tell you something. Every day she would come in. We'd sit down. I have her, and I would just watch that movement. Siri, at around the 21-day mark, it was like I could feel energy slowly starting to get down to my arm. It was delayed, but I could feel something. It's really weird to try to explain this to somebody. I'm sure that you understand that. I woke up one day and I knew I was going to be able to move my arm, and I did. I connected. It connected. And I knew at that moment, I knew that I was going to recover because my body was responding. My physiology was responding and the right and normal way. But I tell you what, no, learning it from that level, you know, I was convinced before, but never like I was when I recovered from being paralyzed. You know, it was really amazing. That just taught me how amazing your mind and your body is if you can focus, you know, to make that happen. It really was something. It changed me forever, made me a better trainer, made me better everything as it related to the people that were coming in to my facility. It just changed me. And it's really weird how something so on the front seems so bad, and it was, but how it was a, I don't know if you want to call it a mixed blessing or not, but it turned out to be really a good thing. I don't wish any stroke to anybody, but it happened to work out for me in a really interesting way, a surprising way I never would have guessed.
Yeah, that's a great teacher for you. I'm sorry I had to go through that.
Oh, man, it was amazing. And, you know, the fantastic thing is, at least with regard to people with strokes, at that time when I had it 8 years ago, because I didn't understand why only 10% of the people were making an almost 100% recovery. I mean, it was a horrible recovery rate for people who had strokes. And so what was going on, I went on the road because I wanted to find out. I'm very curious that way. I talked to all the hospitals that would take me, the support groups, and I wanted to find out why. I wanted to tell my story, and I wanted to find out why. And what was going on back then was that the doctors, they were telling people 8 years ago that after about 8 to 10 months, that's as good as you're going to get. In other words, the window for recovery, it stops. Well, that's not true. That's not true. The key there was that you needed to start rehabbing immediately. If you wait too long, that window does shut down quicker. But if you start rehabbing, which I did immediately, I mean, that window is still open, Siri. Look, that was so traumatic. I still do rehab every single day, and I still think about it. And I'm 100% recovered, but I never want to go back to that. So I do little things that I was doing before because repetition is the mother's skill. I still do that, even to this day. And the other thing that the doctors didn't know back then was how malleable your brain is. In other words, I had the stroke on the left side. And, of course, there's some discussion now about whether or not you can repair dead tissue there. And you can, it looks like. But what the body can do, you probably know all this, is it builds new pathways in the brain. But you got to be willing to go through that process. And that's another reason why people didn't recover, because it beat them down. They got discouraged because it was like bodybuilding. It's a marathon to recover. And I think the sport of bodybuilding saved my life that way, because I thought, look, I didn't build this body, you know, in 2 years or 3 years. It took 15 years to be able to. So I was up for the fight. But most people, like you were mentioning before, the average person doesn't have that kind of mindset.
Well, they don't have it. They don't have a system.
Yeah.
You had a system. And so you attached yourself to your system to bring yourself back.
Yeah.
And as Americans, we don't have a system. They've taken physical education out of the school.
Yep, true.
You know, the Chinese got Tai Chi. The Indians got yoga. People, the different cultures have a system, but we don't have a system. The bodybuilding is a system.
Yep.
And you were able to relate to something external to bring you back, how to cook that lasagna.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, before we wrap up, I want to talk about, if you would like to, I saw here on your bio, you've been with royalty and you've been with billionaires. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how all that happened and what that experience was for you. I'm fascinated by that.
Sure. Usually it's word of mouth, like someone either sees someone and they see that they're in great shape and they say, oh, I need a trainer. So there was a billionaire arms dealer with his own plane. And I didn't know he was an arms dealer at the time. And he wanted someone to travel the world with him and get him in shape. So that was like a James Bond kind of experience there, you know, with his own planes and helicopters and houses in every country and entourage and stuff. I worked with a lady, she heard I trained Madonna. So she called me sight unseen, and she happened to be sleeping with the Duke of York. So I got to train Prince Andrew for 9 days, loved him. I think I'm on his side. I think he's a very smart, intelligent man who's the spare, put in the back the spare. When you train somebody like royalty, you have to be vetted, you know, by the FBI or the CIA, or they have to do a background check on you. And you're usually kept in a certain, you know, like stay in the guest house until we're ready for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as they're paying you like $5,000-$6,000 a week, I don't have a trouble with that.
No, I agree.
Don't have any trouble with waiting for you all day long at that rate, you know? They're more difficult in that they're used to you being in a servant position.
Yeah. So
when you're in the studio or someone comes to you, you're the master.
Right.
When you leave your studio, you're the servant. And it's how to find that line, right?
Yeah.
For instance, our workouts will be at this time, but then they don't show up. And we're flying away on that day.
Yeah.
You know. And then you're like trying to take off 30 pounds, but they're drinking 2 bottles of wine a day.
Yeah.
So the rich and famous are more difficult than guys in jail who are more grateful, who I do that on a volunteer basis for, you know, I just did it a couple times, a volunteer basis, just my soul wasn't feeling used enough. You know, I need to feel like I'm really working and really giving. But the billionaires and the millionaires, of course, I bought my house and all that stuff on that.
Thank you very much.
And I usually do a short contract. You know, there's always a contract. There's always a deal memo. So they'll say, oh, come with me for a couple of years. I'm like, no, let's do 90 days.
Yeah.
It's a contract. So I need to see my program and we're going to do my program or we're going to do a program. And so it's usually, it can be a couple of weeks. It can be a couple of days. In the case of Prince Andrew, it was 9 days. In the case of Sting, I worked with Sting. I was referred by Madonna. That was great. That was one of my best times because he's very disciplined.
Yeah.
Because he'll even tell his story. You know, his dad was a milkman. He likes to start early. He shows up on time. He knows how to work and he knows how to be a student.
Yeah.
Maybe not so true of the wife who keeps you waiting for an hour and a half. Talks the whole time and tells you what to do.
Whole different dynamic, isn't it? But I like what you did with the 90 days, putting it into a smaller, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to see if we can handle this for the, that's what I'm getting from that. If we can handle this for 90 days, then we'll take another step. Is that right?
Yeah. I always do a deal memo. You know, you get that from the movies.
Yeah.
If you don't do a deal memo and you think you're going to get something, you're going to end up in trouble, which is we start here, we end here. This is what the job is. You're going to pay for the plane ticket. You're going to pay for my meals. You're going to pay for my, you know, where I'm staying. And this is what I'm doing. And this is what I'm getting for it. So you have to do a deal memo. Otherwise, if you go on the road with some spoiled actress, you're walking her dog. You're picking up the poop. You're taking her mother to the airport.
Yeah.
You're doing the laundry.
Yeah, you're a glorified assistant.
You're a glorified assistant, which when I was younger, didn't bother me to serve.
Yeah.
But now I would charge for it. So, you know, whether you have an hourly rate, a day rate, a week rate, a job rate, you know, I mean, I'm confident now. I mean, I had a very successful career. So if Warner Brothers calls you up and says, look, I got this guy and I got to get him ready for a love scene. Can you do that? So you have to be very confident in your schedule and your, and your system to be able to do that.
Well, you know, something Albert Einstein said it best. And my dad also said it. So I think my dad was a genius too. When he said, my dad said, you know, it's hard to replace firsthand experience. You've been through it. You know, this is not your first rodeo and you learn lessons along the way and you start creating like, this is what I'm willing to do and not do. And I stand by that. That's what I get from you. And I think that's the same thing that's happened to me is like when I look back and when I first started something, I have a whole different, I almost push people away and say, this is what I expect from you. You know, and if this is not something you think you can handle, we're done. I say it a little more eloquent, I think.
That's very Joe Pilates too, which is your time is valuable. Your time is short.
Yeah.
And you want the person to meet you there. You know, it's like, why are we working like this if you're eating ice cream every night?
Yeah, exactly.
So what is our goals and the no-nonsense approach? I think, you know, what I see in a lot of the teachers and trainers and stuff is they don't have enough technique. So they put a lot of their personality in there.
Right. Exactly. That's the fakers a little bit. From the real deal. It's in our industry too. It's like that.
Yeah. They just want you to like them and, you know, because they need the check or.
Yeah. And they're too much yes people instead of saying, look, I stand for this. And either you take it or leave it because you came to me to get in shape.
This is what
has to be done. And you know, I'm willing to back up. I give money back guarantees, but you have to do the work as well.
Exactly. Like, you know, one of my favorite Madonna stories, you know, Madonna, she used to come 4 times a week. When she was getting ready for her tour. And in the Pilates system, you know, we have about 10 different machines we use, and you can, and you know, one can do 50 exercises or 75 exercises or 100 exercises. So not to get bored, you can move from day to day or each time a different place. And we would come to doing the mat work. Now the mat work is similar. If you want to say what's the similarity between yoga and Pilates is in the repetition. Like in yoga, you would have the sun salutation, for example, putting together a series of 12 movements that you memorize forever.
Yeah.
Joe Pilates had a series of 36 mat exercises, just the mat, which is similar to gymnastics, a roll up or roll over, you're on your stomach, you're on your back. And Madonna didn't really like the mat. So when it came time to do the mat, what are we doing today? I said, well, we're doing the mat. And she goes, you know how I feel about the mat.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know how I feel about the mat. There's only room for one alpha mare in the posture, in the pasture.
There you go. I like that.
That's it.
That's it.
It's non-negotiable.
There you go. I love it. I love your style. Listen, you've got a fantastic energy about you. I love that you came on today to the show. I really do appreciate that. And I want to tell you that anytime that you want to come back on to talk about anything, I'm open. And hopefully you don't mind me reaching out to you another time to keep talking, because I could talk to you for quite some time.
Oh, any time, and maybe we can do some work too.
I'd love that. Anyway, yeah. Thank you again for coming on to the show. And be well, be safe.
I'm in Big Bear at 7,000 feet. It's pretty good up here.
Okay.
Listen. In the right place at the right time.
Love it.
Thank you, Leo.
I'll talk to you again someday.
Ciao, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.